Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Lauren Gawn.
And I'm Gretchen McCulloch. And in this 27th Patreon bonus episode, we talk about how animals communicate. But first, new merch.
We are very excited to have some new Lingthusiasm merch to share with you, and especially with you patrons. We're going to let you know about it, and then we'll tell everyone else in a couple of weeks. But we wanted to give you a head start to check out the new range.
Yeah, so we've now made a scarf and a few other objects with some of our favorite esoteric symbols. So if the International Phonetic Alphabet or tree diagrams, which already exist, if they weren't quite your cup of tea, but you'd like some weird editing, math, music, punctuation symbols, and more, you can now go to the link in the description, which will take you to a scarf and a couple of other objects like a mug, because we hear that not everyone is scarf wearers. Plus,
Gretchen made me a very cute little onesie for our tiny bub that says Mum's Little Longitudinal Language Acquisition Project. And it's such a good onesie that I thought it would be fun to share it with everyone else as well. So we now have...
So Lauren will personally mail you her baby's already worn onesie. Wait, no.
No. We're going to let people buy their own new ones that are...
Oh,
that
good are idea. Okay.
And in a color of their choice. And either say Mum's with an O, American style, Dad's, or just Little Longitudinal Language Acquisition Project to suit your whims.
Yes. And you can check out the photos in this post for more information and links to how to get those.
Today's topic idea came from Janelle Shane, who asked us a question when we put out the request for Q&A questions that we realized was so epic that we couldn't answer it in a quick video answer. And so our whole topic today is, how could we tell if animals or plants were communicating with us?
Which is a really fun topic, and we can make a whole episode about it. And it's a fine line when we're talking about animal communication, because on the one hand, like, yay, it's so cool. Animals can definitely communicate some things. And it's pretty clear at this point from the experiments that we've done that animals don't communicate the same way that humans do, or don't have things that are equivalent to what humans can do. It can't tell you, like, how its weekend was.
I had to read a bit of the literature on animal communication for a PhD class that I took. And one thing I love the most about this literature is that it often refers to quote-unquote non-human animals.
That's true. Humans are animals.
It's a really good reminder that humans are animals and that we don't live separate or completely isolated from, and if our skills are magic and different from other animals, then we still have to think about that in the context of what it means that we are also animals.
I really like the literature on this because you get one of two things. You get the kind of existing pop science-y, like, sensationalist headlines being like, this dog knows English, and like, this gorilla can do everything.
They do tend to talk it up a bit.
Yeah, who talk it up a bit. And then you get the academic side that's like, these animals fail so much. They're all terrible and all bad, and look at all the stuff they can't do. And so I think it's useful to walk a line between those two tones of animals can do some stuff and it is cool. We don't have to consider it in comparison to humans all the time. We can appreciate it for what it is.
But we have to make sure that we're appreciating the right thing, because with animal communication, there has been a lot of dodgy science over the years.
Absolutely. My favorite example of dodgy animal communication science is this horse known as Clever Hans.
Well, he must, like, obviously he's going to be great. His name is Clever Hans. It says it in the name.
He was a horse owned by Wilhelm von Osten in Germany in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And Hans was supposed to have been able to add, subtract, multiply, divide, work with fractions, tell time, keep track of the calendar, differentiate musical tones, read, spell, and understand German.
What a clever horse.
Right? Like, why aren't all horses doing this? So if you can ask him something like, if the eighth day of the month comes on a Tuesday, what is the date of the following Friday? And Hans would tap his hoof 11 times.
Right.
And he could answer both oral questions and written questions. You could hold up a sign with this question on it, and he would tap his foot 11 times.
Clever horse.
Right. Yeah, this sounds so good.
It sounds too good just to...
It is too good.
Right.
So the horse was actually just watching the trainer, and the trainer would be counting, of course, the number of taps, and would know when he was getting to 11, suddenly his body language would shift a little bit. And so what the horse was just doing was like, I just tap my foot until you raise your eyebrows, and then I stop, basically.
I love the idea that if the trainer didn't know the answer to a complicated mathematical fraction question, the horse would also get it wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, because otherwise you could ask the horse to, like, predict the future or something.
I mean, it seems to be able to do everything else.
How many children am I going to have? 11, oh no. But this is the thing, is that it wasn't just the trainer. Anybody who was asking the question, the horse was really good at reading anybody's body language. So it seemed like, oh, well, you know, Van Austin can't be cueing him, because if I go and ask Clever Hans a question, then he can do this too. But he's just, like, very good at following body language.
I feel like that's an underrated skill for a horse to have. Like, putting aside the fact that he can't do math, it's actually impressive that he was able to read the body language of people asking him questions.
Well, and this is the kind of thing that we do train horses to do. You know, if you have a horse on a rider and they're trying to, like, you know, do some difficult jumps or something like this, and the rider's, like, shifting from one side to the other, so the horse needs to turn, like, these are the type of things that horses are very attuned to doing. But ultimately, there was this psychologist called Oscar Pfungst who demonstrated that the horse was not actually doing math, and he did a couple steps, like isolating the horse and the questioner from any spectators, because even if the question asker didn't know it, then maybe the spectators did.
Mm-hmm.
Using other questioners, putting blinders on the horse so the horse couldn't see the questioner.
Right.
To get that kind of, you know, eyebrow raise or a little, like, smile or something. And then varying again whether the questioner knew the answer to the question in advance. And so when Van Austin knew the answers to the question, Hans got 89% of them right. When he did not know the answers, Hans only answered 6% of them correct.
Wow.
So
you need to have a really good approach to make sure you're actually, your experiments are capturing the thing you're trying to capture.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone thinks that Van Austin was trying to defraud people. These cues are probably subconscious. It's not like he's deliberately raising his eyebrows. He's just, like, tense until Hans gets to the right answer, and then he relaxes a little bit or something.
Yeah.
And so even when you don't mean to mislead somebody, you can kind of mean to, like, you know, give the animal cues, you can do this. And this has now informed how we do a lot of kinds of research. Same with, like, baby research. Like, if you bring a baby into a lab, the experimenter will often have it sit on, let's say, the parent's lap while it's doing a study, because you want the kid to remain calm and so on, so maybe they like doing that. But then they'll put, like, a blindfold and, like, earmuffs on the parent so the parent can't cue the baby into, like, the right response.
Yeah.
And that's why that happens.
Hmm. So animals, I mean, discounting children are not children are human animals rather than
children are human animals.
But back to our non-human animals, another creature that has been living with us for a very long time and is very used to reading human social cues, obviously, are dogs. They've been domesticated for at least 10,000 years according to records, and they do some very impressive things that wild dogs don't do. One of them, just putting on my gesture researcher hat again, is that dogs are able to follow a pointing gesture.
Ooh.
So if you point at something, a dog will know to look at the thing. A wild dog and lots of other animals will look at your hand.
I feel like when I've tried to point at a thing for a dog, they're not particularly good at looking at the thing. Like, they still kind of look at my hand sometimes. Maybe they eventually follow the point.
But the fact that they can learn to follow the point is an impressive cognitive feat for animals.
That's a good point. Ooh, wow, pun intended.
The funny thing is that cats, on the other hand, do not tend to follow human pointing.
Ooh.
And there's a division in the literature whether they lack the cognitive ability to use this communicative skill or that they simply choose not to.
That is the most cat thing.
Yeah. I don't actually know if they can potentially do it.
That's great. I choose to believe that they can and they just don't want to. But, you know, the literature's still out on that. I mean, because you can't train cats to do stuff either, right? You can't train them most of the time to, like...
Definitely not in the way that you can train, you know, your average dog breed. There are some cat breeds that seem more willing to be trained to do stuff, but compared to dogs, not really.
Yeah, and there are definitely some dogs that are more trainable than others, but you can generally train a dog to, like, fetch and sit and roll over and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And some dogs, border collies are particularly smart dogs. So there's this border collie called Chaser who has learned to identify by name over 1,000 objects, mostly different kinds of stuffed toys.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this study to try to control for the Clever Hans effect by saying, you know, Chaser, go get your bunny or something. And they put a whole bunch of his toys in another room, and Chaser goes to the other room and selects the bunny out of that and brings it back to the person. And so there's no one in the room to be like, yeah, 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 that one. Chaser has to know that bunny means like the stuffed bunny.
I'm kind of terrified that he has like 1,000 toys.
There's a photo of him just like sitting in this like giant pile of stuffed toys.
Could you imagine setting this experiment up?
I mean, I imagine they kind of gradually built up to it, right? Like, you don't buy 1,000 toys and be like, I wonder how many of these we can teach the dog.
That would be a great, when you have to apply for grants to fund your research, it's like, I need $7,000 to buy an assortment of soft toys and other objects for my dog to play with.
And then you discover that your dog is like not actually as smart as Chaser and you can't teach it more than like two names.
But Chaser doesn't just fetch things, right? He has some other actions.
Yeah, he has three verbs.
Right.
Which is quite cool. So he has the verb get and the verb nose and the verb paw. So you can also tell him, like, nose the bunny. And so he'll, like, poke at it with his nose. Or paw the bunny. And so he'll, like, poke at it with his paw.
Yeah.
Which this, you know, this whole episode is adorable. But, like, this just sounds really cute.
But you can't tell him something he hasn't already been trained. Like, humans are very good at picking up things that they haven't been trained to use.
So they've done some stuff with Chaser where they'll be like, Chaser, go get the frog. And like, they won't have previously taught him the name for that. But in the room where he's sent, there'll be like 19 toys that he's familiar with and one new one. And so he will deduce that that one must be the frog.
Okay, that's impressive.
Like, it's pretty good. I mean, it's not communicative ability. He can't talk back to you, but he can like respond to certain things in like a very certain framework.
Yeah.
But when it comes to talking back to us, the place where people have really tried to make this happen is with the great apes.
And the theory is, of course, that we are most closely related to various great apes, and therefore, if anyone's going to have the ability to do language, it's possibly going to be our nearest relatives.
Yeah, and here there's a big confound, which is that apes literally don't have the vocal apparatus to produce sounds. So you can talk at them like you can to a dog. I mean, dogs don't have the vocal apparatus to produce human language either. Apes can produce certain sounds, but they can't produce the full range of sounds used in human language. And so people have tried a variety of approaches to say, well, but do they have the cognitive ability to produce language? So some approaches have said, well, what if we try to teach apes a sign language because they do have the manual dexterity to produce a sign language? And others have said, what if we try to get them to point at certain pictures in certain sequences so they can use those to communicate?
Fun tiny human fact, just because I have a lot of those at the moment. An infant's head and its like throat, an area that you need to produce language, is more similar to an ape's than an adult human's. And that's part of why, and I mean, they just don't have the muscles to move properly. That's why babies can't talk or use the same range of sounds that adults can, because they're like great apes that don't have the ability.
Well, and that's why they can breathe and nurse at the same time, right? Whereas like,
yeah.
Adults can't breathe and drink at the same time.
Yeah, it comes with other benefits, like not being able to choke as easily, which I guess is useful.
Seems pretty useful to me.
Yeah.
And then at a certain age, right, there something in their throat like descends?
Yeah, so if you look at like a baby's throat, it's much shorter than an adult human's. And it's that descending larynx and the vocal folds area that allows for that greater range of resonances that create the variety we need for spoken language.
So then they become able to, you know, produce English or a variety of other spoken languages, but they also become able to choke, which is a bit of a trade-off.
Yeah.
But yeah, so apes don't have this ability, and there have been various kinds of apes. There's chimpanzees such as Washoe, and possibly the best named one, Nim Chimpsky.
There's a whole documentary on Nim Chimpsky, and the like, I mean, it's a pretty obvious punchline, but the like questionable research practices that happened around trying to teach him to sign, that is definitely worth watching.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's clearly a pun on Noam Chomsky, but like, it's such a good pun. It's great. And then Coco the gorilla was another one that was tried to be taught to sign. Some of the things that come up when you try to do stuff with apes, though, with the signing apes, is that it does create a bit of a sort of clever hands problem. Because in many cases, they're spending a ton of time trying to teach these apes to do these things and try to interpret how the ape signs work. And especially with the case of Coco, she had like one primary trainer who she was very close to, mm-hmm. who pretty much interpreted all her signs.
Yeah.
And what researchers would say they were trying to teach the apes was, ASL. But if you actually asked ASL users to watch the videos of these apes and, like, mark down when they were signing, they would mark them a lot less often as actually trying to communicate a sign than people who were, like, involved in the study who were not themselves already regular signers of ASL.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of wishful thinking going on.
There's a Twitter thread about the kind of current status of great ape research that I'll link to from Iron Spike. And I think the really obvious point they make that is worth taking home is if these studies were at all successful, we would be introducing sign language to all great apes at all zoos.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Clearly whatever gains were made were not worth the amount of effort that was put in compared to, like, your average child.
Well, or even, like, if you get a dog, one of the things you do is you, like, teach it to sit and you teach it to fetch and stay. And this is, like, a thing that is known that you can do with pretty much any dog. And some dogs are going to be slightly better than others, but, like, you can do this with any dog. And it's just, like, generally recommended to do this with every dog.
Yeah.
And the same thing, like, any horse, you can teach it to, like, speed up or slow down with voice commands. And, like, you can probably teach an ape some sort of, you know, very basic thing like this. But if it was just as possible to teach apes how to sign, then we would just be doing this with all the apes that were in captivity because it would make it so much easier to communicate with them. And that's not happening.
And, like, apes are super clever. Like, just because they aren't meeting the threshold for human language that we've decided is all important, they do have incredibly complex social relationships.
Yeah, they use tools.
In zoos, they've taught them to do really complicated things like, you know, respond to the vet correctly when they need to examine particular parts of their body or do particular things. Like, they're not, I think sometimes we go, oh, well, they can't language, they're not as smart as us. But
yeah, and we know they do use tools, which is, you know, a very smart thing to do. But yeah, it's the research here is just really inconclusive. And the same thing with, so Kanzi, the bonobo, who was taught to use this lexigram board that, you know, you point to symbols and it will speak those symbols out loud. And they were trying to get Kanzi to make, you know, phrases out of those. And again, they managed to train Kanzi to do some of this, but it just never quite became a thing that you're going to get all the apes to do and, like, wasn't ultimately fruitful.
I love Kanzi's image lexigram board. They all look like really wacky 80s album covers. All these little symbols that he had to learn.
That's great. We could link to a picture of that. I think another tangent that we can take is, okay, well, we could go for the apes because they're the closest to us, you know, in the family tree, and they've got the right hands to sign, even if they don't have the right brains to sign. But we also know that there's a whole other side of animals that can make human sounds, even if their brains are probably very different from us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certain kinds of birds. So parrots can...
Oh, yeah. I love a good parrot chat story.
Parrots can famously imitate human voices. Like, this is a thing we know about parrots. But can we teach a parrot to understand humans?
Or are they just parroting us?
Ooh. Damn. So there was one particularly famous parrot called Alex the Parrot.
Mm-hmm.
Who, again, you know, is one of these kind of classic animal training studies. And they tried to teach Alex various colors and various words. And the most famous thing that Alex the parrot ever said was apparently he was looking at himself in the mirror and he said, "What color?" And they managed to teach Alex to say gray because he was a gray parrot after many repetitions. So apparently none of the apes who've been trained on language related things have managed to ask a question. But Alex managed to ask one question.
Wow. I love that it's just like, big tick. You've been upgraded.
Yeah. Congratulations. Good job. You asked a question. So, you know, you can do some stuff. Possibly my favorite story of animals learning language is actually crows.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there's a wildlife sanctuary where there are some crows that wander around saying caw in like a human accent rather than quah, quah. They say, like, the word caw.
Humans have spent so much time going, do the caw thing, that they've taken on that.
They're like, oh, you keep saying this word to us. I guess you want us to repeat it. Like, sure.
That's hilarious.
I think it's really good.
Crows are part of the corvid family, and corvids are, like, if I had to pick any birds, they are definitely up there as some of my favorites because they're so smart. And a lot of research has been done with ravens. And the thing is, by now we're like, we're not really focusing on what they say. We're focusing on how they think. And I find it really interesting, these animals that are so far removed from us evolutionarily, but have really sophisticated ability to model what other animals are thinking, because that's like one of the building blocks of the brain that you need to be sophisticated enough to have language. in order to learn language, you have to learn how to, you know, think about what the other person might be thinking so you can ask them the right question. And ravens are really good at, so they can problem solve really well.
Hmm, okay.
They can do problems that 2-year-olds often fail at, 2-year-old humans, and that great apes struggle with around, like, using particular tools to open boxes to get rewards. But they also have the ability to kind of keep in their brain what other ravens know. So some ravens like to hoard their food, and other ravens don't go around hunting so much as stealing from other ravens' supplies. And if they team up with another raven, they can kind of go, I think you're also another raven that is really good at stealing from other ravens' caches, so I'm not going to let you know that I know where this other raven has a supply of food. I'm going to, like, lure you away and trick you so that I can keep that pile of food.
So they're like raven Robin Hoods, raven hoods.
Yeah.
Going around stealing.
Like raven cognition and the ability to, like, figure out who's a competitor and how to psych each other out is really impressive. And it's the kind of thinking that you need to be able to interact in the really complicated ways that we use language, but they don't use what we think of as language.
Yeah, and now getting back out of birds and into mammals again, thinking of bottlenose dolphins, because we know that they keep track of who all of the other dolphins that they know are, because they have signature whistles.
Cool.
Which are unique to a particular individual dolphin.
I want a signature whistle now.
Well, you kind of have one because you have a name.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
Yeah, sorry. So the signature whistle is kind of the dolphin equivalent of a name because, of course, they can't make, like, Lauren. They have to make, like, or something.
Yeah.
Probably not that, because I'm sure they're using a very different airstream mechanism than I'm using.
They do have a slightly longer snout.
And a blowhole? I don't know. So, yeah, but they use these signature things to identify each other. They develop them during their first year, and they address other dolphins by mimicking their whistle. Even if they haven't seen a particular dolphin for over 20 years, they can remember that dolphin's signature whistle.
Awesome. That is very cool.
Yeah.
Because I often don't remember people's names after, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking, I would fail at this test. Like, oh, sorry, yep. I haven't seen you since, like, elementary school.
Dolphins are smarter than me, I think we can definitely say.
So they have really good, like, face recognition, name remembrance.
Yeah. And so I love the stories of things like ravens and dolphins, because they show that it wasn't just a, like, single direct stream of, like, mammals got smarter and then great apes got smarter and then humans got the smartest. Like, all of these different skills that underpin the language skills that we have kind of pop up all across the animal kingdom.
Yeah, I also think it's more interesting when we look at animals on their own terms for kind of, like, what can they do? What can they communicate? What are they already doing with each other? What are they trying to do with us? Rather than saying, like, okay, we need to teach them a specific human language.
Yeah, we start off with the premise of language and see if they live up to it.
Yeah, whereas to look at what can they do and what do they mean by it when they're doing it.
A lot of these studies are kind of focused on how they communicate with us, which I think shows our incredible self-centeredness.
I particularly love this thing that seems to be across many species of animals, which is that animals really like it when we pet them.
True, yeah.
Including many kinds of animals that you wouldn't necessarily expect. So when I was doing some dolphin research, I came across this book called Dolphin Mysteries, Unlocking the Secrets of Communication, which I've only read a few pages from in the preview.
Sounds amazing.
It looks really fascinating. I kind of want to read the whole thing now. But one of the things I did read was this human diver going down and trying to observe a beluga whale. Mm-hmm. And belugas, I know the book's officially about dolphins, but this story was about a beluga. Belugas are known to be, like, very friendly whales. And this beluga was known to be particularly friendly, and the human diver was like, I'm trying not to interfere, I just want to observe from far away. And the beluga's like, no, play with me. And so the human diver's, like, keeping her hands, like, down by her sides, because she doesn't want to, like, you know, reach out and touch it. And the beluga's kind of nosing around, be like, pet me, though? And the human's like, nope. And so the beluga basically comes up with, like, her forehead against the diver's forehead, and it's just, like, sitting there forehead to forehead, like, I don't know, two characters in a movie who are about to kiss or something. There's a diagram of it, it's really cute. And then I kept thinking about, like, other animals that want us to pet them.
Yeah, I'm a complete sucker for those internet videos of, like, otter gets boy to pet him.
That one's really
I know
cute.
They're, like, super problematic, and, like, domesticating animals that shouldn't be domesticated is really bad, and I still click on them every time.
I really like the one with the octopus.
There's an octopus one. Okay, I'm watching this immediately after this.
Yeah, so it's underwater and there's a diver and the diver kind of like scratches the octopus's head and then the octopus like goes away and then comes back and is like, yes, please do that again a couple times. And it's a very clear example of like this wild animal who we can't communicate very much with, but we know it likes this thing.
Yeah, I love it every time. But of course, we shouldn't presume that all animals are trying to communicate with us. That is a very human-centric obsession.
Absolutely. And sometimes they're just trying to communicate with each other.
Yeah, which brings me to my favorite animals communicating within group, which is honeybees and the waggle dance.
The waggle dance.
This is classic, I don't know, I feel like, did you ever cover this in like an intro to linguistics? Is this language discussion?
Maybe, I guess. Not much depth.
So honeybees, when they're in the hive, they use... you were telling me there's some debate about this, so I don't want to, like, upset people whose expertise is bee communication. But the generally put about story is that when they're in the hive, there's these scout bees who will do a particular dance to communicate where honey is. So if it's like close within like 50 meters to 75 meters, they'll do this little round dance on the surface of the honeycomb. But when the food is further away, like, you know, more than 75 meters away, they'll do this waggle dance where they'll do this straight line up in the direction that conveys like, you know, the food that's good is over here to the east. And then the speed at which they repeat this and do this little waggle bit indicates how far away it is. So the quicker they move, the further away it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they can do this, and then they can send other bees to that particular flowers, or if you're doing an experimental context, you'll have like a bowl of sugar water that you're sending the bees to. Mm-hmm. But the bees are also kind of sensitive to other things about the surroundings. So there was this fun experiment where they had a bowl of sugar water and they kept moving it, you know, gradually further and further away from the hive. And the bees were always telling the other bees, like, here's where it is. And so they'd fly it to the new location. And eventually they moved the bowl of sugar water out into a boat in the middle of a lake. And they sent the bees there. And then the bees came back and were like, yep, go here. And the other bees were like, no. Like, no. They like would not fly into the middle of a lake to get this. Even though these bees had previously flown across the lake to get flowers on the other side of the lake. So it wasn't that they didn't want to fly over water. It was just that they were like, that's fake. Flowers don't grow in the middle of the water. Like, we know this.
You're an idiot. That's so great.
So, yeah, the experimenters tried to get the bees to, like, prank the other bees, and they didn't fall for it.
I guess the reason that, like, often this is, like, it's a very efficient form of communication. But as far as language goes, it's A, not very good at communicating anything other than there is flowers here, and B, it's quite interesting that there's not a lot of variation that's being discussed.
Yeah, and there's some controversy, apparently, as I noticed when I was researching this, as to how much it's the dance that's communicating and how much it's the scent. The bees are using, like, scents to communicate where the flowers are and how far they are. And apparently this is, like, a hot topic in bee research, and it's a very acrimonious debate that I had no idea existed.
No, neither.
So that is a thing. But regardless, we do know that bees are communicating this somehow because, you know, they fly directly to where the other bees have told them that the flowers are. But speaking of scents, this is kind of my favorite example of communication because Janelle asked us at the top of this episode both about animals and about plants. And plants don't look like they're doing a lot of communicating, but they do actually do some kinds of communication. So I think the most famous example of this is possibly, you know, that smell of cut grass?
I love the smell of cut grass. It's so nice.
You might not love the smell of cut grass because that is actually a grass distress signal.
Oh my gosh, is the grass upset?
It's being killed.
Oh no.
And it's telling the other grass to, like, watch out, there are herbivores coming, because it doesn't know how to say watch out, there's a lawnmower.
Oh, I feel really sad now.
Yeah, it's a distress signal. And sometimes, for some plants, releasing these chemicals as a distress signal can actually summon, like, insects that might, like, bite the predators on the plant.
Awesome.
Yeah. And in another case, plants can actually kind of hear some of them.
Okay.
I mean, so they don't have ears. We do know this.
Not that I've noticed. Yeah. Except corn.
Ooh, thank you. But the kind of hearing that they can do is like the kind of hearing when you can feel thunder rumbling, or you can feel like a train going by, or like low music, and you're feeling the vibrations through objects.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of feeling the vibrations, plants can do.
Huh.
And the kinds of vibrations that plants are trying to feel for are the vibrations that might indicate that there are insects munching nearby.
Right.
because this is obviously very relevant for plants. And so there was a study, and I found out with a study from the podcast Gastropod, which is a podcast about food that is not normally super relevant to linguistics, even though I really like it. But in this particular case, it's kind of relevant to us because they describe an experiment where some researchers found out the frequency of, you know, subtle leaf tremors that are made when caterpillars munch on this plant called rock cress, which is a relative of cabbage and broccoli.
That is some super sensitive hearing.
Yeah, it's just this like subtle like, but like much quieter. And then they recorded that and then they played that sound to one set of plants and not to the other set of plants. And then they let the caterpillars loose on both plant populations. And they found that the plants that had undergone audio training responded to the attack by producing higher levels of mustard oil, which is a thing that makes them less appealing to caterpillars. So they were better defended because they'd heard the caterpillars coming, essentially.
Amazing.
And they were probably more spicy tasting, I guess, if you ate them.
Everyone wins. I mean, except the caterpillars and the cress.
Yeah. So plants can kind of communicate using, you know, feeling and chemistry to a very non-linguistic sense, but in a way that is really cool.
I think that's part of the appeal of looking at plant and animal communication on its own terms and not being obsessed with, like, is it language? Is that you get to find out cool stuff like this.
Exactly. And, like, looking at how the actual system works and not just trying to kind of impose our preconceived human notions of how plants and animals communicate.
For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I tweet and blog as Superlinguo.
I can be found as @GretchenAMXC on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan. Our audio producer is Claire Gaughan, our managing editor is Emily Greff, and our production editor is Sarah Dopierala. And our music is by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
Stay Lingthusiastic!